with a pretty girl dancing to jug band music and a mess of mama's barbecue.
The legend.
Did you ever see Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas when you were little?
I don't know. I don't think so.
It was a Muppets, like Jim Henson movie, Christmas movie. It was about these otters that lived on a river, and there's all these characters, bullfrogs and porcupines. And
bullfrogs?
And they enter this talent contest to win money to buy each other Christmas presents. Pretty girl dancing to jug band music.
You could be a singer, hubbo.
With a pretty girl dancing to jug band music.
Oh, God.
And are we going to have news?
What was
from
that?
The front?
I was actually kind of thinking that we might do a little news from the front.
Soothing back when there ain't no hole in the wash tub.
Oh, no, Matt, look what you've done.
There ain't no hole in the wash tub. All right.
I hate it when there's holes in my wash tub.
And we are ready to go. Gentlemen, in 5, 4, not yet. We got 10 seconds.
Hubbo, the legend.
You are the legend. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Micah, we are live.
News from the front.
Is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath Terra Firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grailian Bunker. Welcome one and all, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grailian Report, your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual. And of course, we are, as always, broadcasting live via the KGRE Radio Mothership at KGREradio.com. Our little home habitation in the darkest corner of the web. Joining me in studio, as always, is my co-host extraordinaire, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good evening to you, sir.
Eve to you.
Eve, indeed. And celestial positioning to all you guys out there, wherever you may be in Gradio Land. Got a lot in store tonight. Looking ahead, of course, in addition to the news that we will be offering, we're also going to be looking at a little bit of atemporal phenomena, time travel, and really the general study of dimensional space and how, by looking back to history, we can learn sometimes remarkable things. Although, of course, when it comes to anachronisms, as time travel often presents, there are from time to time little mysteries that arise too. And one of my all-time favorite mysteries of ancient history, prehistory, in fact, we're going to be looking at that tonight, as well as some very interesting views from folks like you at home, getting into the spirit of the holidays here, Thanksgiving almost upon us. And of course, when it gets to be about that time of the year, not quite the most wonderful time of the year, but close enough, I want to express always what I'm thankful for. And one thing I'm certainly thankful for is the man back in master control, Mr. Race Hubbo Hobbs. How you doing there, Hubbo?
Fantastic, Micah. How are you two gentlemen doing back on dry land?
Back on dry land, indeed. I can't complain. I mean, I've been a little under the weather. But
Wyatt, I am rolling.
Hey, he's rolling.
I'm rolling.
That's right. As a matter of fact, Matt was probably the time traveler who invented the wheel.
Really?
Yeah, and that's why he's always rolling.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. No, you know, after this last little bit of, oh, by the way, we just got one here from my good pal James Waldo, just sent me a message. He said, Hobbs. That's right. Well, want to say hi to all the resources out there in the chat room who are joining us. Wendy, we just spent a few days at sea with Wendy last week and weekend on the Mysteries Cruise. That was a really great time. Hello to everybody else there in the chat room, too. Hello to all the folks at home and all of you out there who are interacting in other ways. If you aren't already, I highly recommend you follow us on Twitter at Micah Hanks, at Grailian Report on Twitter. Great way to interact with us through the week and find out what's going on. Also get news and updates and things. So everybody ready for Thanksgiving? Almost can't believe it's here yet. Haven't even put the pumpkins out here in the bunker and really decorated. This time of year, I like to get a little bit of that autumn going on, but I haven't quite gotten around to it yet, probably because I've been on the road.
I like keeping up that vibe as long as possible, personally.
So. That's right, yeah. If this is indeed the 4T in twilight, it's always autumn in the bunker.
That's right.
Yeah, so, Race, do you and the Lady Bird get to doing a little bit of the autumn decor this time of the year? I'm sure you do.
It's already all over the home now, already. And the bird has been, you know, doing extensive shopping for the Thanksgiving meal that takes place every year in the residence. And got a big family gathering planned. Lots of friends and family coming, and we're looking forward to it.
You didn't invite us, though.
Oh, we're always invited, man.
Oh, okay.
All right. The door's always open for you two, lovely gents.
The door is indeed always open. Well, you know, one other thing I'm thankful for. I'm thankful for my assistant, Lauren, who has been celebrating a little different, too. She alerted me today that she is planning to, instead of the elf on the shelf that you all hear about, you know, when I was visiting Tiffany Mack last Christmas, she and the family, they were doing elf on the shelf, and the girls liked to get me up and have them bring me up and help them find the elf every morning. Well, Lauren said we're going to do things a little different. She says, rather than an elf, I have selected a Sasquatch to be the purveyor of gifts this year. And so this very same little Sasquatch that Beth Arzee sent us a number of years ago, yeah. Matt, I sent her a picture and I said, Lauren, isn't this the little guy you're talking about? And sure enough, she had gotten the very same Sasquatch that Beth sent us. And so he's a little dusty. This poor little guy's been sitting over here. So I've got a Sasquatch on a shelf too. So I'm going to put this little guy right here. He's going to hang out next to Dergopal there on the desk. And he's going to accompany us as we do our space-time foray into the fringe tonight. One more thing, though, on that note of anachronisms, Race, I just have to tell you, Matt and I found something extraordinary. A lost tome of knowledge in a library floating adrift on the ocean. Matt, do you remember this remarkable discovery that we found?
I remember being in the library.
You and I, yeah, Matt and I, after a night of indulgence and endurance aboard the Crown Princess, we found our way in the middle of the night to the library. And here we were. I was, yes, wearing a bow tie, so we very well may have been time traveling. I remember Matt looking rather dashing as well.
I tried.
There's some photos on Instagram. If you guys don't follow me on Instagram, you can get some updates from the cruise that Matt and Wendy and Mike and I and all the fine folks were engaged with. Jim Harold, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. But we found this book, Race, by this author I had never heard of, and her name was Robin Hobb. No S.
Huh.
Robin Hobb. I didn't know that there was a fiction novelist named Robin Hobb, so I took a picture. But unfortunately, we didn't have cell phone reception, and I didn't send it then and forgot to once I got back ashore. And I just remembered this book we found by Robin Hobb.
Yeah.
My goodness. Imagine that, huh?
Are you sure she's not leading a double life, Hobbs?
I'm almost certain of it.
Okay.
I'm almost certain of it.
Hobbo's wife is actually a fiction novelist, and in order to conceal her identity from Race, what she does is she changed one letter. She removed the S from the end of her name so that no one would find out.
It's crafty.
That's
very possible. She is that talented.
She is. Well, I'll tell you, that's one word for Robin Hobbs. Another one is just lovely. Indeed. I can't wait to see you guys again. I'm looking forward to more adventures in 2018. This has been one heck of a year for news, 2017, and getting right into it, let's wade into the thick of things. Some big news today. It has been announced, Matt, that the leader of the famous cult known as the Family, Charles Manson, he has been pronounced dead at age 83. Now, Manson, of course, has died after nearly 5 decades that he spent in prison, according to several media outlets. He was reportedly taken from Corocon State Prison in California, where he had been serving a life sentence, to a hospital in Bakersfield last week. Apparently, the Los Angeles Times reported and confirmed all this. Manson was hospitalized for gastrointestinal issues at Bakersfield Hospital in January. The man who would become synonymous with pure evil was in his mid-30s in 1969 when he was charged with orchestrating a series of gruesome murders. He was the leader of the so-called Manson family, a quasi-commune. He told followers an apocalyptic race war was coming. This, of course, he called Helter Skelter, and this was the very same name of the book that was later written about all of this. Now, just a while back, our good friend and research associate here with the program, Jason Pintrail, and I spent some time digging into this. We actually recorded a segment for use in a future episode of a program that, after the first of the year, I'll just say this for the time being, but you'll be hearing more about this in weeks to come. A new project I'm involved with and very excited about, but we recorded something, and how prescient it is that it's going to be released after the first of the year. We just found out about, of course, Manson's death today, but that's what we were digging into. And I'm telling you, there was some very dark, very, I mean, that goes without saying with Charles Manson, but really understanding his worldview and ideology, it was quite disturbing. He described the collapse of society as helter-skelter, again, a borrowed term that came, of course, from the Beatles song, and he had been a huge fan of the Beatles. In fact, Manson was quite a songwriter himself. And I may have an audio soundbite here that I would like to reference, because in truth, he not only had an association with a lot of well-known musicians, but some of them actually remarked on just how talented he actually was.
For a few months, Dennis Wilson thought Charles Manson was a music genius. He wrote a song called Cease to Exist.
Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me.
Dennis Wilson brought that song, Cease to Exist, to the Beach Boys, only he renamed it, gave it some new lyrics.
It was called Never Learn Not to Love, and we actually recorded that song.
The Beach Boys actually recorded that.
Yeah.
The song, as far as I knew, Dennis had written.
Never Learned Not to Love, the Beach Boys.
I remember Mike Douglas, and I remember doing a show.
I'm your kind, and I see.
The squeaky clean Beach Boys are singing a song written by Charles Manson on a Mike Douglas show.
I could never learn not to love you.
In light of what happened, boggles the mind. And when it appears on the album, it's credited only to Dennis Wilson.
Manson was furious when he found out that Dennis Wilson had not only changed the lyrics, but had listed himself as the sole composer. When Manson goes looking for Wilson afterwards and at one point leaves a bullet and tells Wilson that I know where you live, I know where your children are, you know what this means.
I gave Dennis Wilson a bullet, didn't I? I gave him a bullet because he changed the words to my song.
Dennis Wilson was so terrified ultimately of Charlie Manson that he ran from him. With anybody else, Manson would have physically attacked him. But he has to live with it. He has to swallow it.
And part of what we kind of, looking into this, came to realize was that some of that craziness in Manson's mind, granted he'd been a repeat offender even before all this, but that starving desire that he had to become a pop star, and again, what was recognized by some as actual talent, but then, in a sense, he felt was robbed from him. That was sort of, in a way, one of the many catalysts that led to the horrific events that occurred with the family. Now, Manson, of course, was trying to precipitate, in his own words, race war when he ordered his followers to kill 7 people, including Sharon Tate, a pregnant actress who at the time was married to famed director Roman Polanski. Manson and 3 of his devout followers, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten, went on trial in June 1970. And then a 5th suspect, Linda Kasabian, yeah, was given immunity in exchange for her testimony against the others.
Yeah, and actually, the interesting thing about the whole Tate murders, at the very least, at that home, was that that home was actually the home of Terry Melcher, who was a music producer.
And that's who he had gone up there looking for with
Yes,
Tex, right?
He had been there before. Dennis Wilson had put him in touch with Terry Melcher. Melcher had produced some Beach Boys stuff. Melcher said, I don't know what to do with Manson, and he just kind of cast him to the wayside. So Manson and Tex had gone to the what would later become the Tate home at one point, what was currently the Melcher home. But months later, Melcher moves, Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski and her friends are living there, and that's when the murder occurs.
That's when the murder occurs, which, of course, Charles Manson was not present for. He was present the following night in a separate incident.
The LaBianca murders.
The LaBianca murders, but he leaves the scene before the actual murders take place, as I understand. Although he may have assisted in tying up some of the victims.
Yes, he allegedly did tie up the victims. Now, the interesting thing about that, and a lot of people obviously connect Manson's music career with the first murder in the fashion that I just said, but not a lot of people connect the second one. And there is an obscure book that I have called The Road Mangler Deluxe, written by a man named Phil Kaufman, who is a famous road manager.
Mm-hmm.
Road managed Graham Parsons, Frank Zappa, Joe Cocker, a lot of people. And most famously was depicted in the film Grand Theft Parsons by Johnny Knoxville because he stole Graham Parsons' body from the LAX airport. At his request, and took his friend's body out to the desert and burned it to set his spirit free. But Kaufman met Manson in prison years before. and said, okay, you've got a little bit of talent. Contact me when you get out. Now, the album that would later be called The Lie, the La Ventura cult album that I have a copy of, and it famously has the Life magazine image of Charles Manson on it, Phil Kaufman produced that and allegedly kind of screwed Manson out of a lot of the royalties. He kept all the properties to the music, and he owned it. Now, Phil Kaufman lived for a time next door to the La Biancas at the house next door.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Nobody talks about that. And Kaufman says in his book, he's like, I'm pretty sure he was coming there to kill me and we weren't home that night and he went next door.
Interesting. I don't recall having ever heard that.
I've never heard it in a documentary, in any book on Manson. I've just heard it in Phil Kaufman's book. But yeah, he lived next door allegedly and knew Manson prior to that.
Very good observation, Mr. Watson. Very good indeed. Now, of course, there was a nearly 10-month trial. It cost Los Angeles $1 million, which was a record that stood under serial killer Richard Ramirez's murder trial nearly 20 years after the fact, factoring in everything, inflation included. I'm the devil, and the devil always has a bald head, Manson told reporters who were covering the trial, as he had shaved his head. Other antics, of course, ensued. In March 1971, the jury sentenced each of the four defendants to death. Manson reportedly shouted to the jurors, "You people have no authority over me," and maintained, of course, he had broken no laws.
Yeah.
Now, Manson's prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi, author of that book, Helter Skelter, from 1974, he died at the age of 80 back in 2015, and he had made it clear to interviewers with Time magazine that, again, I don't use the word sorry as to why, or you know, what his feelings were about why, you know, Manson hadn't been executed, and if he felt sorry about this. He says, "I don't use the word sorry, but he should have been executed. And I told the jury, if this was not a proper case for the imposition of the death penalty, then no case ever would be." Matt, maybe you can recall, what was the situation? Had the death penalty been removed? It was removed in that state right around the time that the verdict
post verdict. It was he was on death row for a while, not too terribly long, but it was repealed fairly shortly after he was convicted, and they were sentenced to death.
I see. So he sentenced to death, and then they repealed the death sentence, and so he sat, instead of being on death row, life in prison. But I remember Manson also saying that he didn't believe that he should have been out of jail. He believed that he belonged in jail.
Yeah.
Not for what he did, but because he said that that was his way of life and where he was most comfortable.
Well, he spent time in the famous boys' home, Boys Town, you know, very famous back in the 30s, 40s. He was there as a child. He spent his entire life in and out of institutions. And I've been reading a lot of the stories today, I have to say, and it's interesting to me how much the myth has continued. You look at places, one of the biggest ones I saw, Hollywood Reporter, the satanic mastermind, Charles Manson, is finally dead. There were no indications of Satanism at the crime scenes.
Why and would they have insinuated satanic?
Know. It's so interesting to me that this myth about the man and what occurred still exists, and it's still shrouded in mystery on so many levels. One of the things I like to point out as well is we bring up Helter Skelter consistently because he wrote that, or somebody wrote that on the fridge at the La Bianca home, I believe, misspelled. And it That's was correct. Written on a door in at the Spahn Ranch. Now, Helter Skelter, coming from the Beatles song, Helter Skelter is a British colloquialism about like a spiraling slide. It's a very whimsical song. And, you know, these are, of course, the days before the internet, so you can't go look up what is Helter Skelter. It's just a slide on a child's playground. And here, it's warped in this man's brain to mean a race war, apocalyptic race war.
Yeah. I tell you, again, a lot of that horrific realization of these kinds of things, these kind of cult activities, and again, the subversive element of control and suggestion that even a crazy person can levy against others in our society. I mean, all of those things culminated with Charles Manson and the family back in the 1960s. And again, it was really kind of a groundbreaking period in American history. A period of cold, hard realization, I think, for many, too. When we come back after this, we're going to be covering a little bit more in the news, including some history and ancient mysteries. In fact, one recent discovery that we're eager to talk about involves something that was found below ground. No, it wasn't our bunker, but you might liken it to being a bunker below a Mayan temple. What will this tell us about the ways of life in ancient Mayan culture. We'll look at that here when we return on the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Fade to Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. It is the Graylian Report. Glad, as always, to be here with you guys. So in some news from a little further south, archaeologists have now said that they believe they found a new passage into the never-before-seen bowels of a Mayan temple from a nearby burial room. This according to the Mexican newspaper El Universal. Now, the passageway begins in the ossuary, a ruined pyramid hiding a macabre bone vault within the buildings of the historic Chichen Itza complex in the Yucatan Peninsula. Now, the route has been mysteriously sealed, and the team of the Great Mayan Aquifer Project has been studying the ruins for months now, according to Newsweek. And they not only believe that the Mayans closed the passage deliberately, but also that it leads to the underground of Chichen Itza's centerpiece. In other words, the large Kukulkan Temple Pyramid. Now, what awaits the scientists on the other side of that passageway?
Secret wisdom. That's what awaits them.
Well, it could be a number of things. I sincerely hope maybe that there will be perhaps some relics or perhaps some sort of other indication of, you know, some of the knowledge, some of the history, some of the technology that the Mayans utilized. We do know, of course, about their advanced calendar systems. We do know, of course, about a lot of their traditions and about the gods that they worshipped. But unfortunately, in the world of post-Columbian contact, there was a lot more that was lost than was discovered. And rather than to try and preserve the traditions of these ancient people, a lot was destroyed in an effort to try and bring them against their will in conversion to Christianity. And so we lost so much information. I sincerely hope that if there's anything that's to be found down there on the other side of this enigmatic new passageway, I sincerely hope that it'll be something that gives us an indication of some of the lost knowledge of the Mayas. No, not about their ancient laser technology, weapons, and flying craft. Come on.
Why not about that?
Because it's irresponsible, Matt, to assert that this guy... By the way, okay, I'm giving Matt a little trouble because he's always saying irresponsible. Some things, let's just be fair, actually are irresponsible and they should be called as such. But I've got a soundbite here. Here it is. Matt, listen to this. This is Matt from, what, I think about 5 years ago here on the show. Maybe six. Let's hear what you had to say 6 years ago on the program.
Just as irresponsible to say that there is absolutely 100% no God as it is to say there is absolutely 100% a God.
See, it's just a recurring motif with you, man.
I stand by that statement.
Yeah, I'm just messing with you. But so coming back to what's going on down there, the team leader, Guillermo de Anda, told this newspaper that, again, they're hoping to find out what is on the other side of this passageway. Now, through the ossuary, we can enter the cave beneath the structure. And there we found a blocked passageway, probably closed off by the ancient Mayans themselves, Deonda said. His team believes a curious geological formation lies beneath, based on the findings of Rene Chavez, researcher of the Geophysics Institute of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Underground shots using an electrical resistivity tomography kit are the closest scientists have been to seeing beneath this imposing Kukulkan temple, which has been nicknamed El Castillo, or the castle by the Spanish. The building, which has the same number of steps as the Mayan calendar had in days, again, this is something that you'll often find when you go to these sites. They were of sacred importance, and often they played out literal physical representations of belief traditions or sometimes also astronomical observations that were made. And so the number of steps on this temple are equivalent to the number of calendar days in the Mayan calendar. And this, of course, served as a central purpose of the local traditions in that region. One of the most impressive functions of the 80-foot pyramid emerges with the setting sun on the days of the spring and fall equinoxes.
And it's further said that in, you'll talk about this, or you'll see this talked about in a lot of different literature, that serpentine shadows appear to slither along the building's northern stairs as sundown approaches before reaching the stone serpent head carved at the foot of the staircase. Matt?
Yes. I'm here.
Serpentine shadows slither along the building's northern stairs as sundown approaches before reaching the stone serpent head carved at the foot of the staircase, where on the day of the summer solstice, the setting sun aligns. Sound familiar at all?
It does. We keep having conversations. You would think I would be turned off at this point because we're discussing snakes.
I don't know. I'm a little turned on, actually.
Are you?
Yeah.
We keep talking about snakes here lately, and usually it freaks me out, but the conversations we've been having seem to be progressing in such an interesting manner that I can't help but be enthralled.
I have to just say, why did it have to be snakes?
Why did it have to be snakes? Yeah.
This is actually fascinating because we've been talking for weeks now about the celestial alignment with the setting of the sun on the day of the summer solstice, and how the setting of the sun aligns with the serpent's mouth, and about our general theory about, again, how this could be representative of an ancient tradition of the sun moving through, passing backward through the zodiacal body of the serpent. And how that could have to do with everything from, again, the traditions of dragons being fire-breathing creatures all around the world, whatever. Some of the symbolism, it could be a little more than just various mythologies that bear certain similarity to each other. There could be a certain continuity between these beliefs, but, again, it keeps coming back to this serpent. We were looking at a John Anthony West book right before we went to air. Again, The Serpent in the Sky.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Egyptian tradition and belief of, you know, and how this relates to the serpent. But again, the presence of the serpent and that continuity. Again, you know, Scotty Roberts, he wrote a book that talked about the pervasive presence of serpents in myth and culture and whatnot. And again, it's something that I think is almost unavoidable. But again, when we hear about these celestial alignments as it relates to these kind of things, I have to say it's quite fascinating. Now, the area around the temple has many natural sinkholes, also known as cenotes, which had a mythical status in local traditions viewed as thresholds to the realm of the gods. Spanish accounts of sinkhole rituals and findings of remains inside them suggest cenotes. James Waldo, I believe you're listening live. He's our team geologist, by the way, who I'll be seeing this weekend. He's going to be supervising a project that Jason Pentrail and I are going to be working on, and James also. But James, make sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is it cenote? I think so, these sinkholes. Anyway, they were used in human sacrifices to rain deities by the Maya, and anything hidden beneath the temple, especially a sinkhole, could give researchers more insight into the mystical religious practices that the Mayans were carrying out there. Also, the labyrinths that unfold in the subsoil of this ancient city have led them to a passageway that they say could take them to the natural sinkhole found beneath the Kukulkan temple, this being a never-before-seen area that so far is only known through the electrical resistivity tomography revealed by the researchers with the UNAM project a couple of years ago. First, we want to prove that it exists because no one has seen it. We only have the images. Then, once we find it, we've got to explore it, DeAnda said. But alongside that exploration of the complex, accompanying engineers have been tasked with developing a 3D map of the underground caves and labyrinths using ground-penetrating radar and drones. Now, again, something I noticed when I was at the San Gervasio site down there on Cozumel Island, there are a lot of karstic caves below those islands. And I had thought personally when we went there, in fact, I tried to go down in one, and the tour guides, the archaeologists on site, they were like, Senor, you cannot go down there. They said, you're absolutely not allowed in those caves. Because I wanted to go in those caves. I was fascinated. I wanted to see what was in these caves. And, and James said that was the correct pronunciation. Thank you, dear boy. Thank you. But I think that, in truth, with the presence of the caves already there, I'd wondered with regard to San Gervasio, were the Maya drawn to that location because of the presence of the caves? Could it be that the Kukulkan temple there at Chichen Itza was actually built upon a site where they already had existing caves, and they built onto that so that they've got the overworld representation with the calendrical association, and of course also the serpentine insinuation, but then you've got this underground complex, perhaps literally representative of the actual Mayan traditions involving an underground. And then finally, when you've got this sealed chamber, this is something that you often see with a number of these sorts of sites, no less the pyramids, of course, and that secret sealed chamber that has, I think, for years captured our imagination. Who knows what's behind that? And frankly, I've always just been fascinated by the technology that was used. You know, in terms of these cenotes, James adds, by the way, he says that term is actually used in particular in relation to the Yucatan, where these kind of things turn up. So see, the geology of the Yucatan, may well have indeed played a role of spiritual significance. Perhaps these people actually built onto these sites because of those locations. Hey, speaking of ancient castles and things that are buried, let's look at something that rather than being buried or anything that was underground, maybe something that's underwater. In Turkey, there's a particular region where local mythology had told about something fascinating supposedly hidden beneath this lake. And Popular Mechanics reports on this, and they said that, again, that local mythology actually scored a victory over modern archaeology when divers discovered this series of ancient ruins. It's 3,000-year-old remains of a castle found at the bottom of a lake. Now, Lake Van sits in Turkey's border with Iran, and in the world's largest saltwater lake and one of the world's largest endorheic bodies of water, meaning it has no outlet to the ocean. The Urartu kingdom ruled the area for hundreds of years, from around 860 to 590 BC. And legends held that Urartu ruins did reside beneath the waters. But Tashin Selan, who's the head of the diving team from Van University, was told repeatedly that even trying to search that lake was just going to be a waste of time. I said, you're not going to find anything down there. Now, Selan said there was a rumor that there might be something under the water, but most archaeologists and museum officials told us, you know, like, you're not going to find anything down there. Now, because it has no outlet to the ocean, Lake Van has been prone to drastic rises and falls in water levels. And when the water level was low thousands of years ago, Urartu colonies made their homes there. According to the divers, about 9 to 14 feet of castle walls are visible below the lake, with mud covering the rest. They say it's now very clear that they had an extended period of time living there before the water rose again. We'll have to hold underwater excavations to find out about that, Selan told the Daily Sabah, meaning that the exploration of the underwater site will continue. But lakes, they say, can indeed hold surprising secrets beyond ancient ruins. The Lost Lake in Oregon, for example, and also, in fact, actually, it's even better known in terms of the rising and falling, because the Lost Lake, as it's known in Oregon, it completely disappears. And so during those periods where it's gone, well, there doesn't seem to be necessarily evidence of habitation, but it just goes to show the comings and goings of certain lakes. As far as Lake Van, though, it had indeed been hiding an ancient secret. And despite being told, hey, look, you're not going to find anything down there, turns out there was a castle. That's pretty neat. So turning our attention from ancient mysteries, well, this is certainly an ancient mystery, but it's something that comes from far, far away. In fact, now scientists know of 750,000 similar objects like this. Yeah, we're talking about an asteroid. Or a comet, in fact, because there's a lot of them out there. And all of them are part of this fine solar system of ours. That is, all of them but one. And as new research is showing, this new one that we're paying attention to is weird as hell. Now, today, scientists are reporting their analysis of what's called the Oumuamua, an interstellar object spotted last month. The oddly shaped, fast-moving rock immediately surprised astronomers with its chemical makeup and other properties, which implied there should be far more interstellar objects floating around than previously thought. Gizmodo reports, quoting one of the authors of the study, that the presence of the Oumuamua suggests that previous estimates of the density of interstellar objects were pessimistically low. Oumuamua's story began on October 19, 2017, when the Hawaiian Pan-STARRS 1 telescope system spotted it. Scientists named it A2017U1, but immediately realized that they were looking at something strange, since its orbit's shape was extremely hyperbolic. That means rather than orbiting the sun, this thing came and went with enough speed to clearly imply that it was from outside the solar system. While the brief visit made the planet difficult to name, the minor planet designation scheme doesn't really allow for naming something only seen once. Researchers created new classifications for these interstellar objects and gave it a Hawaiian name that, quote, reflects the way this object is like a scout or a messenger sent from the distant past to reach out to us in the present. And this according to a Minor Planet Center communication. And again, that weird name, Oumuamua, it means a messenger from afar arriving first. So literally an ancient mystery that has entered our solar system.
It's a great name.
Fascinating in truth. Now, observations of the wildly varying light that astronomers are describing from the Oumuamua showed scientists that it wasn't a spherical shape at all. This is interesting. They say that the shape of this object is more like an elongated cigar. Very unlike most space objects. They say it's about 800 meters by 80 meters by 80 meters. Oh my God, Matt, what if it's a starship? They're coming here. They were right. It's an emissary ship from Nibiru.
How many UFO reports have been reported cigar-shaped objects?
Well,
you know?
This, finally, we can confirm is a cigar-shaped object from outer space.
I'm happy about it.
I am happy about it. It's fascinating. Yeah, they say that this thing's about as tall as the Statue of Liberty, but a mile long. It's red and likely made from metal and carbon-rich matter like some comets are. Now, scientists also observed that it didn't have a fuzzy comet-like appearance like some comets or broom stars, as they were referred to in antiquity.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is surprising, they say, given the fact that most observed rocks originating from the distant Oort cloud are indeed comets. Now, all of this set up a conundrum. Scientists assumed that interstellar objects would behave more like comets than asteroids until Oumuamua came along. If they're more like asteroids, that implied to the team that they are way more, that there are more of these interstellar rocks in the solar system than originally thought. It also adds, according to this paper, another factor when considering Earth impacts. They say impact from an interstellar object would be far more energetic than from a solar system object with similar mass due to the larger impact speed. Now, as far as where it came from, nobody really knows. The paper suggests a nearby debris disk, or that its trajectory was changed by some planet or other comet. Maybe it was set off by the undiscovered planet 9. Ha! They're not kidding, Matt. They said it, not me. They said that, yeah, indeed, this thing could emanate from the undiscovered planet 9 out there. I was just kidding when I said Nibiru, folks. All that information is still speculative, though. Now, scientists will never probably get to see the Oumuamua again as it speeds off, but its brief visit did suggest that it might not be the last time scientists spot something like this. But indeed, this was one of the weirdest observations probably astronomers have come across in years. That's pretty fascinating. You know, despite all the stuff that we know about Earth and life on it, and of course its shape, I mean, while we're looking out there, there are people who still, Matt, dispute the actual shape of our planet. That's right, we have a name for them. You know them, you love them. They're called the Flat Earthers. And recently right here in North Carolina, we missed it. Did you know about this gathering?
We were just talking about it in the chat room. I was saying how depressed I was. We had to miss this.
Do you know where in North Carolina?
I'm not sure where exactly it was, but if it was in our state and we didn't go, I feel bad about it, you know?
Well, I feel terrible. I mean, just imagine this opportunity we had to go down there and educate these people. Not that we would have probably made any progress doing so.
It was in Raleigh.
Okay, it was in Raleigh. Jason, I think, is down that way quite a lot. So I think next time, if you hear about something like this, we've got to send one of our guys there in the Raleigh area. Maybe Jason would look into this for us. Now, the yearly occasion, they say. So it's annual. Look, we may have another chance, Matt. It's held by a group who rejects the possibility of a heliocentric globe Earth. And instead, they say that a flat stationary Earth is what we live on. Oh, my God. I mean, stationary? If it's a flat Earth, at least it will allow for orbit and things like this. But now, apparently, what is said on the side of the FEIC, which I guess is the Flat Earth, is that the Flat Earth International Committee?
It was the Flat Earth International
Conference. Yes. Yeah, okay, that's the website for the conference. They said on their website, God, and they meet in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is hilarious. After broad experimentation, investigation, and research, we have come to realize that reality of our cosmology isn't what we've been told. The site clarifies the group presumes the planet is a roundabout plate shape and that it depends on Antarctica to give a cold divider. Hendrance, who wrote this article? This is from gearsofbiz.com. It's one of the worst written articles I've ever read, but you get the gist of it. So these people were getting together down there in Raleigh, and they were meeting to discuss the flat Earth. So the extent what's under this, I don't have any acquaintance with. It could be this thickness. I'm not even going to read any more of these quotes.
Either. You know, it was only $150 for us to go a piece, a ticket.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, $250 would have gotten us VIP backstage passes.
VIP backstage passes to hear all the evidence that the Earth is indeed flat and that we've been wrong this entire time.
It's a small price to pay.
I guess so, for ultimate truth and knowledge. I'm a little terrified, although albeit morbidly fascinated, to know that, again, the International Flat Earth Conference met right here in Raleigh, North Carolina. I mean, we're not in Raleigh, but, I mean, that's not far from here. Who'd have thunk it, Matt? Who'd have thunk it?
I'd have paid for it, though. No, I really wouldn't.
I'm sorry. I would not have paid $150 to go and hear the theories of the Flat Earthers. This horribly written article goes on to say, let's see if I can find where it was. They mentioned at some point something along the lines of that the Earth and its globular nature was discovered by Aristotle, which, as I understand, is not correct. Actually, before Aristotle weighed in on the circular shape of the Earth, of course, we had Eratosthenes, who had made the original judgment. Oh, gosh. So if you're going to be debunking the ideas of flat earthers, at least get your own facts straight. But see, this is one of the things that the flat earthers don't like. They say, well, see, you guys based that original judgment by Eratosthenes. You use that as the basis for your knowledge that you believe that the earth is actually round. So, I mean, come on, talking about dated material, going back to ancient Greece for your evidence, guys, really? Especially in this age of satellites and, you know, imagery and all. Oh, wait, that's right. But then again, the satellites
aren't real and the images are faked, Michael.
That's right. The images are actually photoshopped. So what evidence are we actually left with? Listen, I know that the ancient mariners knew that they could watch a sailing vessel disappear over the horizon, which to them suggested that there was a curvature of the earth. I know that, Matt, when you and I travel down to the Dominican Republic on a cruise, we can look up into the sky and the arrangement of the stars that we see is different from what we see when we're up here in the high mountains of Appalachia, because upon the globular surface of the earth, that curvature, we travel from this point down to an area closer to the equator and we're seeing a different portion of the stars than we're seeing right here. But don't bother these flat earthers. I wonder how many of these flat earth people have actually traveled further than maybe a couple of states away from their home. Because the airlines must be in on this secret too.
What you're failing to realize is that NASA has a giant projector that projects the night sky. Okay?
Wow, I didn't think about that one.
Yeah. That's a real theory, by the way.
Is it really?
Yeah, I am not kidding. I've heard people pose that.
How do they explain where the night sky came from back in the days before there were projectors?
Ancient aliens.
Must have been the aliens. I mean, who else could it be? Really? Yeah. Call Cowboy Matt. We're going to need him. In fact, actually, we may need a shovel because it's getting pretty deep around here. I may have to dig my way out of this one, Matt, but oh, gosh. Well, here's what I'm going to do. Next year, if they have another annual meeting in Raleigh, I'm going to appeal to the Flat Earth Society and see if they will give us press passes. I will go and represent Team Graylian if they will give us press passes. I'm not paying $150 to hear a bunch of cockamamie junk from Flat Earthers. We'll be back right after this. Broadcasting from the dark depths of the hollow earth, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. I'm sorry, I had to stop there for a second. I realized if I took one letter out of my name, I could pretend to be a thriller writer and no one would know who I actually was, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking it was your teenage alter ego, Micah Angst.
Yes, I was pure angst personified when I was tiny. Yes, indeed. Actually, I'm not that tiny, and I wasn't when I was a teenager either. And one of the first things that people often say when they meet me for the first time is, well, apart from, wow, you are so much younger than I thought you were, based on the way that you sound on your podcast. The other thing that they often say is, you're taller than I thought you would be, too. That's right. Unlike some of us out there who I believe, despite all protests, are tiny. But anyway, Matt, speaking of something, and this is no small matter whatsoever. There's a mystery going on, and this involves the disappearance of an entire submarine belonging to Argentina's Navy. But if the disappearance itself weren't concerning and mysterious enough, there is already now another mystery layer upon this to be added, and that may indeed indicate hope for the missing crew. That's because Argentina's Navy is analyzing a noise they said may have come from a missing submarine and the 44 missing crew members. Navy spokesman Enrique Balbay said that on Monday, the noises heard by two Navy ships had come from around 225 miles off the coast, and that the position was in line with the path that the ARA San Juan would have taken to reach its planned destination. Now, the ARA San Juan disappeared 268 miles off Argentina's southern Atlantic coast on Wednesday, with the UK, US, Brazil, and Chile, as well as Uruguay, while assisting in the search. Seven failed satellite calls were received on Saturday, Argentina's defense ministry said, raising hopes that the crew were trying to reestablish contact, but it later emerged that they had not come from the missing vessel. Initially, the country's navy suspected that the submarine which left the southern city of Ushuaia for Mar del Plata, more than 1,800 miles away, had suffered a communications problem of some kind. The navy later revealed that it had reported a mechanical breakdown in its final transmission. Keep in mind, this was a diesel-powered submarine. And during my own experience on board a nuclear submarine as a backup, they also have an old-style diesel power source on board these submarines as well. The crew were thought to have, now granted, I've never served in the Navy, and no, I've never been deployed and spent time aboard an actual active vessel. The vessel that I've been aboard is one that I was given clearance to tour and visit. In fact, actually, Race Hobbs, our very own producer extraordinaire, he too has toured a nuclear submarine because we were both granted our clearance by a friend, a mutual friend. And I tell you, there's nothing quite like being on board one of these. They're truly incredible vessels. And unfortunately, there are a lot of countries out there that have vessels, or maybe fortunately, depending on how you look at it, who don't have the state-of-the-art technology that we do. That didn't work out for the better with regard to the Argentinian crew here. They were thought to have several days of food supply on board that ship, by the way, but unlike nuclear-powered UK and US submarines, this being a diesel-electric means that there is a very finite supply of fuel on board this thing. And that's not just fuel. There's also a very finite supply of food and oxygen, too. So according to national Argentinian newspaper La Nación, it was subjected to years of complex repair and engineering work in 2008, which the country's navy believed would extend its life by 30 years. Well, in terms of extending life, the only thing that will extend the life of those who are trapped on board this thing, wherever it is finding them. So our prayers go out to them. We hope indeed that they are found. Nothing more claustrophobic and terrifying that I could possibly imagine, Matt, than being trapped on board a submarine that is experiencing those kind of problems while at sea. So we hope that we get them out and that they are rescued in due time. Hard to believe that we've already got an hour behind us. When we come back after this, in addition to a listener email, I want to talk about something very unusual that was seen in the skies over Oregon and the Northwest last week. It's got a lot of aviation experts scratching their heads. What was it? We'll talk about that when we come back on the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to where we meet together every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with Matthew Oakley, my comrade and companion in space-time, Race Hubbo Hobbs out there, pushing all the right buttons and making us sound good. Of course, all those fine folks out there in the chat room and those behind the scenes feeding us information, knowledge across space and time. You know, you can do that also if you would like to send along information, news tips, stories, or emails. Best way to do that, send them to info@graylianreport.com or info@micahanks.com. All those emails come to the same place. I will be sure and get those. And with time, get around to them. If time allows. That's the problem with time travel, which we'll be discussing a little later in the hour. But that problem, of course, is that no one ever seems to be able to find the time. We hope to try and do that, too. If you, on the other hand, have time on your hands,
and need something to do with it, consider right here around the holidays subscribing to Graylian X. It'll get you additional weekly programs, which we call, of course, the Graylian X podcast, and the monthly specials, Graylian Enigmas. It's that time of the year again, and so coming up in advance of Christmas, we're going to be doing one of our famous M.R. James specials, a extremely creepy Christmas tradition. Back in the day, in the British Isles, it was commonplace that on Christmas Eve, they read very scary ghost stories. And some of the very best Christmas ghost stories are written by M.R. James. We like to feature those each year for Graylian Enigmas. Something to look forward to, not your typical stocking stuffer. But if you already are a subscriber, consider Graylian X as a gift to somebody else. They may enjoy it too. Or if you've got somebody who wants to learn how to podcast, this is indeed something that you can put in a stocking as a stuffer. Get a copy of The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting for them, which is a book by yours truly. You can learn all about podcasting the way that we, the Graylians, do it. And if podcasting and learning about it isn't something that's quite your cup of tea, if you go to MicahHanks.com/books, you can learn about other books I've written. There may be something there. In fact, I would guarantee a little something for everybody in the way of the books. So consider adding those to your library. I, on the other hand, I have so many books around here, Matt, I really don't know what to do with them all. And I think that the only logical conclusion is I'm going to have to do an additional, not a renovation per se, but maybe I'm going to have to build onto the property. I'm going to have to, Graylian Manor is going to have to expand. I'm going to have to add an east wing just so I can fit all the books in here, a new library area. It's the only way I could figure that we could get them all in.
It's never a bad idea. I'm starting to catch up a little bit with you.
Got a few books.
Yeah, I do.
I was telling Jason Pintrill the other day, I wish that we all, the Seven Ages research team, lived a little closer together, because then we could all kind of have a common library area. And again, you know, this concept, it's been rolling around in my mind for quite a while now already, the Library of the Lost, collections of esoteric books and unusual things which really kind of culminate knowledge that is less often discussed and certainly less often found. There's more information about our world that has been lost to time, lost over the ages. If indeed there were civilizations or technologies wielded by those that we know of in the ancient past, so much of that would have been lost at the burning of Alexandria, the sack of Constantinople, all these kind of things. And to tell you the truth, the same thing happened with the Maya at the time of the arrival of the conquistadors. So it's really sad how much knowledge we have lost. One more reason I'm so adamant about preserving what knowledge we have today. It's very important. Books are always something to be treasured in that regard. Also treasure information that comes from other sources, not just books, of course, but communications that we share with people, Matt. And there are a lot of historical notes of very important value that come to us over the years as a result of letters that people exchange and share. And a lot of the time, historians use this as firsthand knowledge of the way of life of people who wrote these letters, and of course, the environmental or political, cultural conditions that occurred at that time. And so we like to feature letters from people on this program too. Roger writes, you know, I was reminded of something this morning, and so I thought I'd send this in an email. I'd never heard of the third man effect until that news story a year or two ago about the little baby that was caught in a car seat under the bridge. Now, for those who aren't familiar with this story, what happened was there was a child who was captured in a car seat. The mother, unfortunately, did not survive the car accident that had the baby pinned under the bridge. But when rescue operators arrived, they were trying to rescue the child, and they said that they could hear a voice. Many of them said that the voice of someone who was urging them to try and rescue the child could be heard. Now, the child was too young, couldn't have been the child. The mother, of course, was presumed dead on the scene. And so the mystery remains as to where exactly that voice came from. And some refer to this as being an instance of what's called the third man factor, where in a moment of impending peril, there is the psychological perception of there being another person there, either helping, assisting, directing, sometimes talking to people. It's a very interesting concept. So Roger writes, anyway, when I was in high school in Indiana, I was a freshman in 1984, incidentally the same year as the setting for Stranger Things. There was a girl in my high school class whose parents, both her mom and her dad, died in the MGM Grand Fire in Las Vegas. Now, we were in high school, and it was several years afterwards, so I asked her if she'd ever heard of something that I'd heard about. I asked her about reports of a person that appeared high up in the tower while it was on fire who had been urging people to jump to their death. Now, we only know this from survivors who did not jump, but had reported this person
or as some might interpret it as being maybe an entity, that was urging people to commit suicide during this fire. Now, since some people did not jump and actually survived the fire, I never had the sense that this was a benevolent third man. In other words, this psychological factor that involves something that is urging people to persist and to push on through adversity. Keep in mind that Ernest Shackleton, I had even said that they believed while they were making their way across Antarctica that there had been a ghostly fourth figure right there, when in fact they knew that no such character existed. So could there be such a thing as Roger supposes here, an evil, a less than benevolent third man? He said, very creepy to say the least. No one reported having seen him before the fire broke out afterward. So if there was ever an evil third man, this would be it. If this isn't a completely original paranormal topic, it's at least extremely rare, as an evil third man effect has not come up as a topic of discussion anywhere that I've listened. Maybe your highly skilled and overtly compensated team of researchers can dig something up on this or other instances of an evil third man. A side note, I saw a documentary years ago on bridge jumpers at the Golden Gate Bridge, and because of my memory of the MGM grand events, I always wondered if any of those people got up there and changed their minds at the last moment only to be pushed off by unseen hands. Creepy, no witnesses left to say otherwise, so who knows? Very interesting concept there. So, Roger, thank you as always, my brother, for sending that along. He always sends along some very great information. And that is indeed an interesting subject to explore, to consider, into different iterations and less than benevolent ones as it relates to that third man factor. Now, something else that was sent along to me recently, Matt, that really had me thinking. James Waldo, who we've mentioned on the program already a couple of times tonight, he had sent me this story initially early in the week, and it involved a report of a mystery aircraft that was seen out over Oregon. Now, I often talk about the fact that, you know, more often than not, you hear reports of alleged UFOs where people say, it was there, maybe even several of us saw it, we were so shocked we forgot to take our cameras out, nobody took a picture. Well, there's a rare criteria for what I call good UFO reports. And those have to involve corroborative data, sometimes cross communications between different agencies that will confirm after the fact that an incident occurred. Agencies like NORAD, sometimes flight traffic control operators at various locations, the U.S. Air Force, all these kind of things. And also it helps if there are recordings, like we've looked at in the past, Matt, where we have reports of police dispatch recordings where they've been responding to a sighting of a UFO and they're talking about and sometimes describing in real time what they're looking at.
Yeah.
These recordings, all these corroborative data really help. Those are the distinctive minority, though, those kind of reports. Well, this rare criteria for a good unidentified aircraft report did surface recently as it relates to an incident that occurred back in October over the California-Oregon border. The story first appeared on Reddit, might have been dismissed as largely speculative or hearsay had it not been for the fact that a writer for The Drive named Tyler Rogaway had also heard about this incident previously from associates of his in the aviation industry. And obviously the story had already created a buzz, and rather than just appearing on an unsubstantiated Reddit thread, it seemed that based on what he had heard from his friends in the aviation community and then later reads on Reddit, that plenty of people had actually been there, had seen this. This seemed to have been something that happened. Now, that story, and we have further corroborative details, I assure you, later, but that initial story went like this, and this according to the Reddit thread. Just landed in Seattle coming from the Bay Area. Beginning over southern Oregon, we kept overhearing Seattle Center attempting to track an airplane with no transponder who wasn't talking. A handful of crews were able to track it visually. Best they could tell, it was between FL 350-370, that's 35,000 to 37,000 feet, northbound. Nobody close enough to see the type. Last we heard, it was over the Willamette Valley northbound, and some fighters, perhaps out of the PDX Portland International Airport, were scrambled to take a peek. Center had trouble tracking it on primary radar. My theory is that they were running drugs to Canada. No news yet, not that I could find. So anyway, there was an update posted by the Redditor. He said, I called CARTCC. The gentleman I spoke with said that they initially got alerted to the aircraft from Oakland Center, who was painting it on primary, illuminating it with radar, but without transponder information. For whatever reason, they couldn't track it themselves on primary, and that's when I overheard them using airline aircraft to track it visually. The last airplane to see it had to descend into Portland and lost sight of it. The fighters were scrambled out to PDX, but blew around for a while and did not find it. That's that. So this report didn't give a whole lot of information about what the aircraft that they were looking for was, and due to the fact that it was unresponsive via radio or radar systems, the pilots had been communicating with other pilots and crew of commercial aircraft in the vicinity to try and obtain visual confirmation. Could they see this thing? Well, basically all that they described was that it was a what appeared to be a white airplane. It appeared to be flying in the same general altitude, speed, maybe a little faster than other aircraft nearby. But there was one description of the aircraft's flight behavior that was a little unusual. They talked about a sharp turn that some of the pilots observed it making, which seemed to be outside the range of maneuverability of conventional aircraft. And if that's true, that one detail I thought might support the idea that this could have been some sort of a military craft. Now, later recordings of the communication between the commercial aircraft that were tracking it and the Seattle ATC was made available. And it details the pilots attempting to try and track this aircraft. Again, you can hear them describing it. They can all see it. Some are saying, yeah, we've got visual. It looks like a white plane of some kind. Again, this thing was not activating the anti-collision technology on board these aircraft. It didn't appear to have a transponder. It didn't appear on radar. And it wouldn't respond to radio communication. So Tyler Rogaway contacts the 142nd Fighter Wing based out of Portland International Airport, the FAA as well, and also the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD. He contacts them on behalf of the drive and tries to get any further information. The FAA doesn't provide a whole lot. The 142nd doesn't either, but NORAD almost immediately responded, and they indeed confirmed that an incident involving multiple airline crews, air traffic control, and F-15Cs from 142nd Fighter Wing based out of Portland did occur. NORAD further said, and I quote, that airline pilots were asked by FAA air traffic controllers to help track and possibly identify a white aircraft traveling in the flight levels nearby. It was roughly between 35,000 and 40,000 feet based on radio recordings, this evidenced by the recordings that were later released. Now, perhaps most compelling of all had been that the group of F-15s that were scrambled out of Portland, which presumably had been sent to intercept the mystery aircraft, okay, they said that they couldn't find this thing. Again, keep in mind that the 142nd, they didn't respond when asked for their quotes or information about this. Now, one Reddit poster who had been posting about this in the initial Reddit thread that appeared claimed to be an ATC control operator themselves, and they said, and this is interesting, our QA department was working on this today, and we got a call from the commander of the 142nd at PDX. We were basically told to knock it off, that we know nothing. This statement, again, maybe can't be verified as it appeared on Reddit, but if it is true, and this is from an ATC operator out there, then it suggests at least that they were told, look, you guys, hush, you didn't see anything. Something that you do hear about in a lot of UFO reports. Now, I found that pretty interesting. And I have my own theories about what this might have been, but there are a lot of theories that are circulating. And first, I want to go over, because Popular Mechanics weighed in on this, and they offered some expected, you know, skeptical interpretations of this, although to me, the description of an airplane being seen by pilots doesn't necessarily entail something out of the ordinary or an extraordinary claim.
Yeah, and that was actually my first introduction to this story. You started cryptically messaging me about Popular Mechanics the other night. I had no idea what you were talking about because I was having a brew with several friends. And yet Sunday morning, I come across the Oregon story. So now I have a frame of reference.
You do indeed.
The gap has been bridged, so to speak.
The gap has been bridged. And now, Mr. Watson, here are the facts. So, according to Popular Mechanics, they said one of the Reddit users quoted by the article thinks it was an aircraft running drugs to Canada. While anything's possible, the aircraft was not keeping a low profile in the way that you would expect a smuggler to do. The mystery aircraft was flying a conspicuous flight path, traveling during broad daylight and passing multiple passenger aircraft. It seems more plausible smugglers would probably fly low enough to avoid possible identification by other pilots. More importantly, the U.S.-Canadian border is 1,538 miles long on the ground. It would be much easier to cross the border in a four-wheel drive truck than in an aircraft. Another possible, and keep it in mind, by the way, I'm going to weigh in on each of these theories as we come to them. The idea that it was drug smugglers, why would they be flying at 4:30, sticking out like a sore thumb by not communicating with other aircraft, which of course gets the attention of NORAD, and they actually scramble jets to go out there and try and find out what this unresponsive aircraft is that's not appearing on radar. Doesn't sound like a smuggling operation at 4:30 in the afternoon. Another possibility is a classified government aircraft, perhaps some highly classified new design, Popular Mechanics continues. They say this theory, too, has problems. If you want to keep a plane secret, then flying at dusk in one of the densest air corridors in the continental United States doesn't make sense. There lies the problem with many possible explanations. If the pilots of the aircraft didn't want anyone to know their business, why did they fly in such a conspicuous manner? It's a good question. Now, I actually do not rule out the military aircraft theory, which we'll come back over and discuss a little later. Popular Mechanics continues, one more theory, Boeing is partially based in Washington State and is working on an entry into the Navy's new MQ-25 Stingray drone competition. The drone probably includes at least some stealthy design characteristics that would make it difficult for civilian air traffic control radars to track, and an unorthodox design that may make it hard for other pilots to visualize. And so the drone operator may have been unable to hear air traffic controller queries of this aircraft. But there are plenty of places to test new drones, particularly over the Nevada desert, and flying an unknown aircraft in a dense aviation zone is potentially hazardous. This is something I addressed in my book, The Ghost Rockets, that if these are drones, they are flying outside the known corridors, which are, again, those typically associated for test craft, including drones. But this obviously is something that is a continuing problem. Aircraft of unexplained design and unknown origin that do appear from time to time in flight corridors where they probably should not. And finally, Popular Mechanics says, and this is my favorite of all, Matt, or maybe there was nothing there at all. Could it be possible that all the pilots who reported the aircraft were actually seeing nothing? After all, radar saw nothing. Told by air traffic control, someone in a position of authority, if there was an aircraft in the area, could the pilots have, quote-unquote, seen something that just wasn't there? Yeah, I think that's, well, I can't say on an FCC-regulated broadcast, but this, again, gets into this whole realm of you hear. I went back and listened to the recordings. They said, yeah, we can see it. We've got visual. It appears to be a white aircraft. I can't determine the exact design, but, I mean, you can definitely see it. They described its maneuverability, its characteristics, its rough altitude, numerous pilots. Oh, yeah, they could have been hallucinating.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of information to have for a shared hallucination. I mean, not to discount the idea of shared hallucinations, but in this instance, I think that is the most far-fetched theory.
Well, I would think any logical person would think so, too. And to their credit, they write, even the hallucination explanation has a problem. Oh, really? Even the hallucination explanation has a problem. Really? Okay, let's hear this one. They said, if the pilots so easily experienced what amounted to a mass hallucination, why is this phenomenon not more common? And why are these pilots flying? One pilot, United Flight 612, is asked by air traffic if it sees the mystery aircraft at his 3 o'clock position, and he quickly pipes up, yeah, we got him. He's about 4 miles away. It is apparent from the tone of his voice that he had been watching the object, which he later describes as a white speck about 4,000 or 5,000 feet above us. Now, again, if we were to apply this same logic to certain other UFO reports, however unconventional they may seem, when you've got a pilot who says, yeah, we're watching, we see the object. Sure, I know a pilot can be mistaken about things that they see, but when they say, yeah, we're watching it, we've got the traffic and our visual, I don't think that we have to go to extraordinary means to explain this. By the same token, I think it's a rather extraordinary explanation to assume that people might not have seen anything at all. Somewhere in the middle, my God, there might be logic applied to this, and, oh, shock horror, what if they saw a plane? What if what they saw, the quote-unquote UFO, wasn't anything otherworldly at all? What if actually what they saw was literally just an aircraft? Albeit perhaps one of unconventional origin. One thing I haven't heard anybody talk about as it relates to this, although the drone theory there comes pretty close, and I think that that's a good assessment of how this craft might have been flying in that area and why there wouldn't have been any response via radar or from the actual radio. But again, one other theory is that if indeed this was some sort of military aircraft, and rather than being a training exercise, it was involved in some sort of an actual mission of some kind. On the civilian level, we certainly wouldn't have a need to know for that information. It would seem strange that NORAD would be out of the loop on that, though. But by the same token, you would think that if there was a drone being tested and this was something that could cause any kind of potential hazards, that once again, military authorities, NORAD, other agencies would have been alerted to the fact that the aircraft would have been tested in that area at that time. So, more than anything, what this sounds like to me is it was probably some sort of a failure to communicate.
Well, I have to say, one thing we talked about on the Mysteries Cruise that I think is relevant here is the way people have manipulated drones, private drones, and scared a lot of people. There was a story and this is what I brought up on the cruise, was that there was a story, many stories coming out of Mexico several years ago of flying luchadors, you know, these wrestlers rocketing through the sky. But it was people, you know, modifying their home use drones and flying them over crowded areas to scare people. People do weird stuff too. So that's a possible explanation, I think, as well.
And even known drone technologies sometimes have a somewhat startling appearance. You know, one of our law enforcement fellows out there who listens to the podcast while he's out there during his patrols, he was a state trooper, I believe, out west. He was on his patrol, and he said that he observed a drone come up over the hill, and he watched it, and he said it really startled him the way that it appeared. And he actually submitted a report to us here on the Graylian Report. And said, you know, I'm going to be keeping my eyes out to see if this drone shows up again. But, I mean, it was obviously a military craft, but he said to actually see it in flight, it really shocked him, the way that this thing flew, the maneuverability, the apparent, you know, shape. And, again, keep in mind that, for instance, the XF-7B doesn't have a traditional rudder like a jet. And so when seen from the side, it can have an almost saucer-like appearance.
Yeah.
And depending on what angle you're seeing these aircraft from, they can have a rather esoteric appearance indeed.
We should ask Tom DeLong about this.
Well, Tom DeLong would just tell you that he couldn't tell you anything about it. That's the problem.
Yeah. Can't really talk about that right now.
Can't really talk about it. Ah, oh, goodness. I'm thinking we're going to go to break. And when we come back, I'm going to get into a bit of ancient history and mystery. But I do want to actually touch on something kind of fun because, you know, for all the animal lovers out there, I've got a couple of dog stories, too. One, and this one actually talks about our canine kindred and our associations with them long, long ago. But another story, which might have been more well-fitted for Halloween had it arrived in time, involves an ancient cult of a sort of sacrificial nature. What did it have to do with belief in werewolves? We will talk about that and more when we return here in a moment on the Graylian Report. The dark heart of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. So I said I wanted to get into a little bit of animal lore. This actually having to do with an 8,000-year-old set of engravings found in the Arabian desert, believed to be the oldest depictions of dogs, not just of dogs, but of dogs on leashes.
Man's best friend.
And perhaps that idea of man's best friend is something that really goes back even further than we realize. Archaeologists have discovered a set of engravings in Saudi Arabia that date back at least 8,000 years, which depict a hunter accompanied by 13 dogs, two of which appear to be on leashes attached to the man's waist. That or it's Slender Man petting a bunch of dogs.
It could go that way. I was just thinking the same thing.
It could be Slender Man. Just saying. The engravings are the earliest known depictions of dogs on leads and suggests that humans were training dogs to assist them with hunting thousands of years earlier than previously thought. Now, Science Mag reports that the engravings were made on a sandstone cliff in Shuwamis, a region in the northwest of Saudi Arabia, where more than 1,400 rock art panels have already been found. The petroglyphs were known by the local Bedouin for centuries, but were only drawn to the attention of authorities in 2001. And since that time, Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Jena, Germany, and the Saudi Commission for Tourism and National Heritage have been working to catalog the rock art panels. Now, among the massive collection of engravings, researchers were particularly interested in the ones that showed hunting parties involving both man and canine. A number of scenes that have been recently cataloged show dogs being used as hunting partners, some running loose beside a hunter and others tethered to the waist of their master. It's truly astounding stuff, this according to Melinda Zader, an archaeozoologist at the Smithsonian Institute and National Museum of Natural History in Washington. It's the only real demonstration that we have of humans using early dogs to hunt. pretty fascinating stuff. But of equal fascination to me, although half as old, we have a 4,000-year-old study that is, well, the study is of a 4,000-year-old find. And this is indicative of members of a Bronze Age culture that lived along the Russian steppes, not only who practiced ritual sacrifice of dogs and wolves, but that the young men then consumed the remains as part of an initiation ceremony evoking the mythological transformation into a werewolf. Now, some of you guys may know, of course, the stories from ancient Greece. And this is where that term lycanthropy actually comes from, that prefix lyco, and King Lycos or Lycaon, and the angry god-king, of course, cursing the man who tricked him. And as he runs away, he is transformed into a wolf, according to the legend. Well, archaeologists discovered the charred remains of more than 60 canine species, almost all dogs, but a few were wolves too, at a settlement in this portion of the Russian steppes. They said eating dog would have been considered taboo at the time, and yet researchers found evidence that the ritual was performed by this particular community repeatedly, maybe as a possible ritual ceremony marking when teen boys entered manhood. A paper detailing the finds was published in the Journal of Anthropological Archaeology. The dogs and wolves themselves were first roasted and then filleted, and then the overall practice draws enough parallels to Indo-European mythology for the researchers to theorize about its meaning. They said that their heads were chopped into small, standardized segments with practiced blows of an axe on multiple occasions throughout the occupation. Not the kind of thing we like to hear happening to pooches these days, so keep in mind this is 4,000 years ago. We argue that it was an initiation, therefore, into the widely attested Indo-European institution of the youthful male war brand, symbolized by transformation into a dog or wolf. Now, this, of course, is believed to have helped them absorb the powers of the wolves. The young men formed war bands and raided neighboring communities. In a previous paper, Brown, one of the authors of this study, wrote that the symbolic association between dogs and death is so pervasive that war bands like these also appear in Greek, Latin, Celtic, Germanic, and Indo-Iranian culture practices. But let's not forget, of course, that the Egyptians and Anubis, yes, we had a dog-like creature, Anubis, which is associated with the entrance into the underworld. And once again, yes, we have canines associated with death. Now, the settlement dates to approximately 1900 to 1700 BC. The culture we're talking about, called the Srubnaya, lived a partly hunter-gatherer lifestyle, but also kept some domesticated animals. The archaeologists discovered some human bones from the Srubnaya themselves, mostly belonging to children, but also found a pit containing the bones of dozens of dogs. The careful way that they'd been arranged suggested that the killings were indeed all ritualistic. The dogs and wolves weren't eaten for everyday sustenance, but killed in the wintertime for coming-of-age ceremonies. So indeed, it's kind of strange, but once again, we see this curious mythological parallel where there's a consistency between belief and myths from different cultures over time and in different parts of the world. And whether it's in different parts of the world or not, again, it's just fascinating to me to see that these consistencies continue to emerge. That stuff is indeed extremely fascinating. Okay, kind of changing gears, but really in truth, staying in that same vein of thought right there, where we're talking about unusual things from the past. I want to talk about a little something that has been on my mind since probably my early days. And this involves the Dogon tribe of Africa. And there's been a lot of debate over what exactly they were talking about when they seem to have knowledge of the binary nature of the star we recognize as Sirius. Okay, now Sirius is the brightest star in the sky. It had a prominent place in many ancient cultures due to this fact. It's about 8.7 light years from Earth, and it has a white dwarf companion star called Sirius B. But here's the problem with the Sirius B component. It can't be seen with the naked eye like Sirius can be. And astronomers actually first guessed about its existence back in the 1830s. There was a mathematical theorem, a model that was put together about its orbit around Sirius, which is now referred to as Sirius A, because later in the 19th century, it was confirmed indeed that there was a Sirius B. Now, they knew that Sirius B had to have been made up of a super dense matter, but the specifics were beyond their comprehension until quantum physics helped explain it. That didn't happen until 1926. So well into the 20th century, we find out that indeed, based on these earlier observations of irregularities in the movement of Sirius B, astronomers had to consider that, well, maybe a third star, Sirius C, might exist as well and exert an influence on Sirius B's orbit. And in fact, until fairly recently, I mean, it's remained a debate as to whether there is a third star, Sirius C, or not. But what is known is that, according to the Dogon in Africa, they maintain traditions that well before Western astronomers were aware of the existence of Sirius B, they, in their cultural and artistic renderings of Sirius, that there was the little companion star, although invisible, it was well represented in their art. For them, Sirius has always been, in fact, a three-star system. They allegedly accurately described Sirius B. They said it was a companion star for Sirius, but that it is invisible from Earth. They nonetheless knew about it having a 50-year orbital period. They said it traveled around Sirius A along an elliptical path and that it was made of a heavy substance not found on Earth. Now the question would be, if all of these were indeed accurate observations made by the Dogon prior to modern astronomy, how in the world did they know about it? The Dogon are also said to have understood that the Earth and other planets rotate on their axes and that they orbit the Sun, that Jupiter has four moons, and that Saturn has a ring around it. Sadly, to all you flat earthers out there, the Dogon were aware of the fact, seemingly, that Earth was round. So even the Dogon knew it, and maybe they knew it before Eratosthenes. Now, an article by NASA's Chandra Observatory had stated that Carl Sagan commented in his book Broca's Brain, "The conclusion about planetary orbits, though a rare insight, is one that can be achieved without high technology, as demonstrated by some Greeks and Copernicus. As for the moons of Jupiter and Saturn's ring, with a combination of extraordinary eyesight and perfectly clear skies, it just might be possible to see them without a telescope. I can tell you from staring at Jupiter on a very bright, clear night, I've never seen the moons of Jupiter without a telescope, ever. But with at least moderate magnification, with the use of a telescopic lens, you can quite clearly see them." And this has caused me to wonder about certain references that we find in antiquity to magic mirrors and things. The descriptions of some of these magic mirrors that were allegedly wielded by some of the ancients do describe if we were to call it a mirror, again, that could be a translation, an issue with translation. What they actually describe is an object, a lens that they could look into and that they could see things far away as though they were right up close. It sounds an awful lot like a telescope, doesn't it? And some of these, although they are often discounted as being just pure hearsay, they do sound an awful lot to me like early descriptions of telescopes. And I've wondered if it isn't impossible. I mean, there are some theories that hold that maybe even some of the Norse sailors themselves had even utilized telescopic lenses, crude though they may have been, that would have helped them with their navigation of the oceans. Indeed, there may have been a lot of people. I mean, again, you look at the Antikythera mechanism, and they were able to utilize simple mechanical computation to chart the stars in ancient Greece. Surely they probably could have also created telescopes. Problem is, we haven't found one of these ancient telescopes, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility that somebody might have put two and two together and discovered that this thing did indeed exist, and yes, well before its actual discovery. Now, again, there are a lot of people who would maintain, and this is actually the concept that was put forth by Robert Temple. He wrote a book called The Sirius Mystery. He said that obviously the Dogon knew about Sirius and Sirius B. They knew about it before modern astronomy and therefore aliens. In fact, that's exactly what he tried to say. He said that aliens probably instructed us, or the Dogon, about what was going on there. We have audio.
The information comes from a tribe in Africa, in Mali, the Dogon, who have astrophysically precise numerical information and predictive information, which has now been substantiated by radio astronomers. Mm-hmm. It cannot be chance that they know the precise orbital period of an invisible star. Mm-hmm. They draw pictures of the orbit and they know the orbital period. But the information goes far beyond that, because they then describe this star as being made of a substance which does not exist on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They specifically say that,
mm-hmm.
and they talk about how intensely heavy it is. And we know that Sirius B is indeed made of superdense matter, which does not exist in our solar system. Mm-hmm. And so where did the information come from? That's the Sirius mystery.
Right.
Now, if you ask the Dogon where it came from,
mm-hmm.
they will tell you. And that's what nobody wants to hear, because they say that their ancestors were given this information by visitors from the system of the star Sirius. That's what they say. Now, we may not like it,
mm-hmm.
but that's their story and they're sticking to it. I think that we have been visited here on Earth by extraterrestrials.
and that we are being monitored. At the very least, we're being monitored.
This is continued from the first visitations up to the present day.
Yes. Now, we may not be being monitored in what's known now as real time. Mm. It may be a retrospective recording by cosmic anthropologists with technology that's got recording devices that are now so small with this advanced technology of these extraterrestrials that they're invisible to us, as ours are becoming. We're already talking in nanotechnology speculations about computers the size of atoms and all this kind of thing. Well, imagine that you'd gone beyond talk and had actually done it. So there could be a speck of dust floating in this room, which would be quite up to recording our conversations and filming everything and transmitting that off to some sort of giant supercomputer somewhere that's orbiting in the outer solar system, creating a massive record of the history of this planet and its civilization.
So anyway, Robert Temple had some very interesting ideas right there about, again, the study of or the observation of our civilization and recording. To me, while interesting, that's entirely speculative. And others have looked at the Dogon mystery, and they have wondered, well, again, is this necessarily representative of those who came from this star system, presumed to exist, Sirius A, Sirius B, travel to Earth? Did they come here? Did they travel to Earth? Did they study us? Did they bring knowledge? Did they leave this with ancient people about their presence? And this is how the Dogon knew. This was Robert Temple's explanation of this, and of course, one popular among those ancient astronaut theorists, popularized on the modern program Ancient Aliens. But many alternative theorists do not go so far as to say that aliens traveled here and presented us with this knowledge in ancient time. Again, Graham Hancock would look at this through the lens of, well, actually, lenses being wielded by the ancients. Maybe people did have much more advanced and sophisticated ability to observe the heavens, and hence, like our modern astronomers, they were able to observe and record that data somewhere along the way. That data trickled down through the ages, and certain cultures were able to maintain some of that ancient knowledge. However you look at it, and there are some that go so far as to say maybe the Dogon didn't really know about the companion star to Sirius A. Maybe that is a modern interpretation. Again, one of the skeptical arguments that's been raised, in fairness, I have to raise this, they say that there doesn't seem to be any reference to actual cultural artifacts prior to the discovery. They believe that the Dogon were copying things that were known by early astronomers who did actually know about Sirius, and that this is, or that indeed it was, again, nothing in relation to astronomy at all, but that modern astronomers from the West interpreted it as being such. If it is what it appears to be, there is the strong suggestion that they had known about the companion star before it was actually discovered by Western astronomers. If that's the case, to me, again, it's not that unusual. It just begs the question, how did they know about it? And it does suggest that maybe there were technologies in use much longer ago, and that although the technology may have been lost along the way, knowledge of the discovery could have indeed been passed down. And we seem to be finding more and more evidence of those kind of things. Again, what it really comes down to is, do we really undermine human ingenuity and the potential technologies that people are capable of discovering and wielding? I think that the ancient people of Earth probably knew an awful lot more than we give them credit for, and yet, for some reason, modern humans today, biologically completely identical to those ancient ancestors who would have discovered these things, for some reason we can say that they couldn't have done that. You know, we look at them as though they're actual alien beings themselves. They were people. They were human beings. They couldn't have discovered those kind of things.
And think about how much garbage they didn't pollute their minds with without the internet and without cable TV, without pop music.
I don't know. I mean, you know, but what's funny is that you look at like some of the representations of that. Reminds me of a particular figure that is known as the Dancer. And the Dancer, she is a girl who's striking a pose. Again, archaeologists look at her and they say she must have been a dancer because of the, you know, the sassy pose that she makes. This would have probably meant that she had a position in society that was probably important. Perhaps she was actually a queen or at the very least a princess. And I'm thinking, but if we were to look at a Playboy magazine where humans maybe from, you know, 2,000 years in the future, if they looked at a Playboy magazine and they saw these pictures of, you know, models and whatnot, would they have looked at those women and said, this is the epitome of this ancient culture, and therefore these women were probably queens or princesses? Or, again, I don't know. That's the problem, is that we often look at things through this kind of a cultural lens. We look at the past and we try to interpret everything through today. And I love this, by the way, Matt, when I'm sitting here on the radio and people, I tell them I'm on the radio and that I can't text, and they look at, you see this conversation that, you know, I can't talk right now, I'm because I can't text and talk at the same time. Look, I've got some superpowers, let me tell you.
More than several.
Yeah, but texting someone who's sending me 1, 2, 3, 4 text messages there asking a series of questions, I just told them I'm on the air. I can't answer your text while I'm talking. I'm seeing text. I'm not hearing talking. Anyway. So I am fascinated by the Dogon thing. I don't know if it is indeed evidence of lost civilizations, lost technology, or aliens touching down and talking with the Dogon like Robert Temple thought, but it is a mystery unto itself. Whatever that mystery is, it's something that I think at least is a head-scratcher. We could at least consider that maybe there are some vestiges of lost technology from the ancient past. And I do have to think about that in, I think, a complementary way with my existing research into whether or not there were varieties of telescopic technology that existed. I mean, very well could be the case that some people in the past did have technology like that, and yeah, that they turned it skyward and looked at the heavens. We'll wrap things up when we return here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. So we've spent a little time traveling back in time, but what about actual time travelers? Matt, I know you put together a segment here, and about one particular time traveler's horrifying warning about our future.
It's quite terrifying, I would say. So this is a fairly recent report, which is interesting because I've seen a lot of these time traveling reports on, you know, social media feeds and all over Google and stuff here lately. So this is a new one. It says, over the last month or so, we've seen a couple of stories about people claiming to have either traveled in time or to have uncovered the secret on how to time travel. And while many of us are often quick to brush off such accounts as far-fetched nonsense, there are some people out there who believe it. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic, though, this one account of a self-proclaimed time traveler is sure to make you a little unsettled. In a bizarre YouTube video, a man named only as Noah claims that he has traveled to the future, and what he's seen isn't exactly pretty. The video, posted by a channel called Paranormal Elite, brings with a short introduction explaining Noah was part of a government project in America and is using a false name due to fear of being assassinated. It goes on to say that Noah has some mental health issues due to his years of time travel, and that while he appears to be young, he has actually lived for about 50 years. Then, Noah begins to speak. From the offset, the man seems to be pretty shaken up. He talks quickly and unevenly, and despite him using a voice distorter, it's easy to tell that he is nervous.
And actually, you know what? Let's hear what Noah... Yeah. But look, I want to do this like James Lipton from the Actors Studio. May we speak to Noah?
Hello to everybody who's watching me right now. I want to be clear while making this video. It is not my intent to deceive anybody. My sole objective is to prove to you that time travel exists in the next few years. In fact, I, myself, am a time traveler. I have traveled back to November 13th, 2017, from early in the year 2021. First of all of time travel will become possible in the year 2003. It is, however, only used by top secret organizations. The ability to time travel is not planned to be released to the public until 2028. Sorry, just give me a minute.
Noah begins to break down at this point.
This is the time period in which I spend most of my life. This is the time period that I belong in. But I've been fired. I can't get back to my time.
Now, keep in mind, he's saying, and he's crying because he says he can't get back to his time, which is 2021. I'm like, dude, if you wait a few more years, you'll be there already. You're going home the long way around. Just hang in then. You know, you're almost there. Really, is this worth getting that worked up over? Come on, man. It's like just a few years from now.
Yeah.
Only problem, what I'd be more worried about as opposed to not being able to get home, because obviously you're going to be back home, I'm more worried about you running into your other self and then causing a temporal paradox.
Can't he find somebody to validate this? Like, he should can be able he to find go, his old self?
Well, if he is, he appears to be a teenager, but he's actually 50 years old, he should be able to find himself with no trouble.
Yeah.
You know, a version of himself should be around.
Or at least somebody who knows him, right? You know?
Well, you'd think.
Yeah.
I wonder
or knows the past him.
Who knows? He says some more, though. Here's some of the startling predictions that he makes. Not the music, actually. Let's skip ahead a little.
Exists, including who the president of the United States is in 2021. In just 4 years, you will see that my predictions are true. Then you'll come back to this video and know that time travel really does exist. In 2028, the private organizations will admit to the world that time travel is real, and it will be open to the public. Now I will tell you the reality of our future. For one, electric cars and self-driving cars will be dramatically improved. A consumer electric car will be able to drive over 600 miles on a single charge in 2021. Many people are spending a lot of their time in virtual reality. I would highly recommend investing your time and money in sustainable energy, virtual reality, and artificial intelligence. AI will also be a huge and growing market in 2021. Wearable technology is also becoming increasingly popular in 2021. There will also become a very popular device, sort of like a Google Glass, that will look like a normal pair of glasses, but have a processing power of today's desktop computers, if you know what I mean. It will be equipped with a high-definition video camera and augmented reality screen. Now I'm going to tell you the winner of the 2020 presidential election in America.
Okay, here it comes. Ready? We're going to find out who the president will be in 2021. Okay.
I promise that the president of the United States after 2020 election will be Donald J. Trump.
Donald J. Trump, he promises that after the 2021 election that the president's going to be Trump. Trump's going to be reelected. Now I know this guy's been smoking something. Yeah, so looking ahead to the future as always, Matt, it's hard to know whether we will eventually meet time travelers from the future who educate us about those things yet to happen and give us some sort of an almost paranormal ability to perceive future events. But with or without time travel, I can look ahead and I can say that indeed, if we have anything to do with it today, we can ensure that our future is bright by being mindful about things happening today. And that's part of the reason I think that when we do this kind of work, we study the past also. Knowing the past helps ensure a bright future, right? That'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, we bid you guys adieu. And on behalf of Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, Tiffany Mack, Assistant Lauren Matthew, and I remain your Graylian here in the heart of the Hollow Earth, your doctor in space-time. And we bid you adieu, my friends. Until next time, as always, you stay strange out there. And we will talk to you again soon on the Graylian Report.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.